Hello and welcome to the Albion Obsessed podcast. You join us on the back of a defeat against title-chasing Liverpool, but you also join us in a week where the Albion fan base have had quite a lot to discuss, especially in regards to our head coach, Roberto De Zerbi. But before we get into that, let's see who we have on the show tonight. We are joined by Joe. Joe, my friend, good to see you after the international break. How have you been keeping?
Yeah, been watching a bit of international football, been watching the controversial England at the moment, but we won't get into that because that's been a whole thing. But yeah, I'm all good, mate. It's good to be back, good to be chatting about the Albion. As I said, I'm feeling a little bit negative, a bit pessimistic about the rest of the season, maybe got my eyes on next season already, but who could blame me after what's happened this week? Yeah, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, man, I'm not too bad. I do share some of your thoughts, Joe, in regards to sort of like feeling like the season is now a bit of a damp squib, but there's still a lot to play for. And of course, we'll talk about that as we move through the show. My house is a bit of a building site at the moment. Currently getting a new kitchen after the house got flooded last year. So I'm in a sort of a permanent state of semi-anxiety because I can't use my kitchen, which is like my safe space because I love to cook. So, but that will hopefully be done by the end of next week. But less about that and more about our friend Dagan. Dagan, my friend, it's fantastic to see you again. How are you?
Tom, doing great. It's spring break here, so I have a week away from work. Nothing wrong with that. Of course, I went into work this morning, but nonetheless, I didn't have to. And so it was nice. No, it's nice to have a little break. It's nice to be on with you guys. Excited to talk about all that we're going to talk about. As is typical, I guess I remain optimistic. But I would say of the rest of the season, I'm in a place where I'm feeling maybe more hopeful than truly optimistic. And we'll talk more. Glad to be here.
It's a strange one, Dagan. I'm going to bounce straight back to you there, mate, because I don't know if you recall, but at the very start of the season, maybe about five games in, we'd sort of obviously had a fully fit squad. And we'd played some fantastic football. I think we'd won four of the first five, or, you know, we had accumulated quite a lot of points. And you sat there and you said, why not us? You know, why not us? I think we can now safely say the reason it's not us is because of the ridiculous amount of injuries we've had. But do you think it's a bit of a shame, Dagan, that you've sort of lost that optimism?
Well, I mean, yeah, we didn't get points when they were there to be had. And that was the feeling we had all the way through, right? All the draws at home against teams that we should have picked up 3 points from, it catches up with you. And now we're facing what we knew was going to be a very tough end of the season schedule. Yes, we could pick up some points that maybe we aren't supposed to on paper. That's why there's still that optimism, but we would have to play better than we have been. You know, the hope in me is João Pedro comes back and we're a better team for that. But I don't know if there's any sign that we're going to see Mitoma anytime soon. You know, Sally March, certainly that, and there was some talk that he might make an appearance this year. That does not seem to be the case. I never thought that was going to be the case. So, yeah, I mean, it is sad. And I think the injuries played a big part in dampening that enthusiasm. But even with a weaker side, we had opportunities to pick up points, and we could very easily be sitting right on the outside of the top five right now and still talking about Champions League, just with a few breaks going our way and having, you know, capitalized on a few opportunities. So I wouldn't look and say I was wrong to think what I thought in the beginning of the year. I still feel like we had the quality to compete at the highest levels at the start of the season. I think, you know, I felt like we'd compete in Europa League, and I think we would have, you know, us without João Pedro is just a very different team, and certainly missing our wingers in support as well. It's just, it's hard to make up for the kinds of losses that we've had. But I don't feel like the season is a failure as I feel like some people do. Maybe a half a step back, but not even a full step back. And, you know, if we finish in eighth, I feel like it's aligned with the trajectory of the club. Lower than eighth, and it's a little bit of a disappointment, but only a mild one.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty astute way of looking at Dagan. I certainly don't think the season has been a failure. However, I perhaps am in that sort of camp where I believe it's a missed opportunity rather so than a failure. Joe, you opened the show talking about sort of like you felt really pessimistic. Well, lots in the news this week to make you feel even more so. because the rumbling saga of Roberto De Zerbi's future is coming full steam into the station now. It's been reported this week by Andy Naylor in The Athletic that the chances of Roberto De Zerbi being Brighton and Hove Albion's head coach next season have receded. He's been asked quite openly in press conferences about his future. Reports have come out that have said he's been in contact with Bayern Munich, although Bayern still haven't decided who their main target will be as of yet. And this has got a lot of fans quite riled up, certainly very annoyed with some of the comments that he has made, especially in regards to speaking about wanting to speak to Tony Bloom and Paul Barber at the end of the season to better understand their plan before making any decision about his future. What have you made of this saga, Joe? Because there's been some heated discussion on X. A lot of people now very sort of seemingly not anti-De Zerbi, that's the wrong way, but the mood has certainly changed. What have you made of all?
I just think it's an absolutely ridiculous time to be speaking about your future when you've still got 9 games to go. And a really tough end of the season to play out. I mean, we've still got to play City, Arsenal, United, Chelsea, Villa. You know, we've got a lot of really tough games left. And I guess you could probably laugh at me and say Chelsea's not a tough game. They just drew to 10-man Burnley at home. But you bet your bottom dollar they'll turn it on when they come and play against us, which will be really frustrating. So I just think it's something that's really silly for De Zerbi to be talking about, because if we hear it, the players hear it, Tony Bloom hears it, Paul Barber hears it. There just seems to be a stupid time to unsettle what I thought was a really settled camp. I think we're under no illusions as Brighton fans that, you know, when De Zerbi's performed so well for us, that there would be other bigger teams looking at him. But I just thought that there was a little bit more respect for him to not mention that before the season is done. And to really, I think he's been quoted before saying he wants to focus on his job at Brighton. I don't think he's doing that with what he's saying. And especially with reports coming out that he's been in contact with another club, it just makes us loyal fans feel a little bit unsettled, which is a completely fair feeling to have. But then again, we have to remember the business of football. The, you know, what I got told when Graham Potter left, I was told by the head of the Chelsea Supporting Association that football is a business and we just have to toe the line. And it feels like that's happening again, where we have our say, but who are we to say? We're little old Brighton of Albion. We have to toe the line. We have to know that our best assets are just going to move on because they can't stay at Brighton, surely. Why can't they? You know, all of this stuff that's come out about how much profit we've made, the fact that the Moises Caicedo money isn't even involved in those figures. Why not stay at Brighton? We're going to have an incredibly healthy position going into this next transfer window. And why would you not want to be a part of that and see what that squad can achieve? I get that it's wait and see, ifs and buts, but I thought that's what De Zerbi liked. And yes, he has to understand the motivation. We have to try and understand the motivation, because we've questioned our owners in terms of not replacing Moises, not replacing Alexis. So I think he's right to question it, but there's a point, and I think he has to stop now and just focus on these next 9 games, because he runs the risk of affecting that relationship that he said wouldn't ever be affected because of what we've achieved together. I'm sorry, Roberto, but you just need to stop now and just focus on what's next. And if you do leave in the summer, you will leave with our full respect, whatever, but just don't muddy the waters, because we're a very hard fan base to rile up, I think. And I think our buttons get pushed when loyalty comes into question, because we're a very loyal football club. So yeah, I think it's got to work both ways.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts there, Joe. Before I give my own, Dagan, I'd like to get your opinion on this. Do you share Joe's sort of views on it, or are you of a different mind?
I think I'm a little bit of a different mind, and I certainly understand where Joe's coming from. One of the things we love about Roberto De Zerbi is that he speaks. He speaks his mind. He speaks his heart. He says all, right? And it's very endearing when we like what he's talking about. right? We're like, man, this guy's so open, and he tells it like it is. And, you know, he's a little rough in handling some of the players sometimes publicly in the media. I mean, it is sort of who he is. His character is to speak plainly, to speak the truth. You know, sometimes we wonder if something is, you know, lost in translation a little bit, as his, you know, he's still newer to the English language. He's adapted incredibly well, as we've noted. The conversation about Liverpool, the conversation about Bayern, I mean, these are conversations that would be happening in the media somewhere. If he wasn't addressing them, there'd be a question of, why is it so hush-hush? Why is nothing being said? The truth of the matter is, those people are interested in him. Of course, he's considering his options, as anyone in any profession would. And whether it's in the middle of a school year or a season, right? If someone's knocking on your door, the time to listen to them is now. You can say, hey, I'm not going to make a decision until later, but you're going to hear that proposal out. I think in terms of Brighton, I think the questions he's asking are fair. If he's getting invitations potentially to go to clubs that are perennial in the Champions League, and he has that opportunity now, if he is going to stay with us, I think he's going to do so only because he believes that our intent is to become one of those clubs, to get him to be a manager here that is at one of those clubs. And I think he might even be willing to stick it out with us if he feels like we are in earnest going to pursue that. I think, at least in terms of hindsight, that would reasonably be put into question by the absence of some of the moves that we here have noted. He certainly has, right? To bring in only one option in Baleba, right? A relatively unproven one to replace Caicedo, Tom, as you've pointed out numerous times, maybe brought our intentions into question. Right. Certainly we wanted to do well, but did we spend enough to do well? Should we be sitting on 80 million profit instead of 120 million profit? Right. Is a fair question. And so I think it makes perfect sense for him to want to sit down and to say he wants to sit down with Tony Bloom and Paul Barber to understand, seriously, what kind of money are we going to spend to bolster the squad in the summer? What are we willing to do? Because I think we need whoever he thinks we need, Locatelli or Dewsbury Hall or both, right? Like, whatever it is. But if he has a vision for how we get there, and I know we're not building our squad for a manager, and we have a long view on how we assess talent. But at the same time, if he's leaving something that's pretty attractive on the table, whether or not we think he's ready for it and is going to be successful is immaterial. How he feels about it is what matters. He may have that same level of doubt, but the opportunity, once it's on the table, is on the table. And if he stays at Brighton and stays where we are right now, because the squad is such that if we're injured, we're going to finish 10th. To me, he has to think, I probably need to strike while the iron's hot and take this opportunity. But if he really believes he's going to be given the tools here to succeed and bring us to the top of Europa League or the Conference League next year, and eventually become a Champions League side in 2 or 3 years, right? Maybe he wants to do that. Maybe he wants to build a club into a Champions League team instead of going to a Champions League club and being great there. I think he has that kind of drive, but I think he has to see that we're a partner in that work. And right now, I think he has reason to doubt whether we're quite where he wants us to be. And I think Tony Bloom has good reason to be hesitant to leap all the way in. And so it's a really difficult situation, but I don't mind him speaking on it, because I think if he weren't, we'd just be wondering and people would be asking questions that were left unanswered and just speculation. So would be, you know, rampant, even more so than it already is. So that's a long answer to say, like, it doesn't bother me. It's one of the things we've liked about him all the way. So I don't feel like we can flip the script and say, well, I don't like that he's talking, because he's been talking the whole time. Yeah. Sometimes probably too much.
I think for me, it's like a defense mechanism when I feel this way about Brighton, because I just set myself up for disappointment. I always go to the worst possible scenario and just try and accept it. Because I feel like if I do that, then when it does happen eventually, I'm going to be able to move on from it a lot quicker. When the whole Graham Potter saga happened, it affected me quite a lot. And I was like pissed off for like a week. because I was just like completely mind blown by it. And so I think there's some scars. It's really weird, like it affects us that much, isn't it? But I just think that I'm just putting up a wall.
Yeah. And I think part of it for me is I'm not worried either way. If De Zerbe stays, I think he'll do a great job. If De Zerbe goes, I think whoever we hire will do a great job. I believe in the club so much. And I believe in Bloom and Barber and their strategy. You know, I can't fully know the timeline. We can't fully know the timeline. And those things are approximate. But I do think there's a sincere goal. I think it's just a question of whether those timelines align between De Zerbe and Bloom and Barber. One thing working in our favor, our relative financial strength, and Tom, I know you're going to talk about this later, compared to other teams' real need to sell, I think is going to create a market that may make us more comfortable going after bigger names at a bargain price relative to what they might be in another market. And that's like the little inkling of hope that I have that maybe we're going to be even more aggressive than we were last summer, in which we spent, what, $100 million, I think, on players last summer. So it wasn't like we did nothing. But again, if we duplicate those efforts and then maybe ramp them up a little bit more, bring in a couple of higher end, you know, $30 to $40 million guys, it could look very attractive to De Zerbe or another manager who has big dreams.
Yeah, I think there's definitely two sides to this. And I think for myself, I fall on more of the Dagan side of things. I think it very much depends on how you're wired. Me personally, I don't like ambiguity. So I would much prefer an honest, I don't know yet, we're going to have a discussion at the end of the year, rather than a no comment. Because if you turn around and say no comment, that leaves so much open to interpretation. And then my mind, the way I just work, is I, perhaps like you, Jai, I go to the worst case scenario, but then I overthink and I stress and I worry. But at least this way, it's given me time to sort of process it. Whereas like Graham Potter, you mentioned, Joe, that was almost like a 24, 48 hours, bam, damn. I didn't have any time to sort of process that. I remember, I mean, I'm digressing here, but I remember like seeing a text from you guys at like 10 in the morning about like, oh, Chelsea are after Graham Potter. I left work at like, say, I think it was like 5. And you guys were saying, right, we're going to jump on a live stream because he's gone. I was like, I had no time to process it. Whereas this, I've got time to process it. And I don't personally have any issues with what he said, wanting to talk about the vision, the plan. And I get that, because if they've had a discussion last season, at the end of last season, about what they wanted from this season, for me, seemingly, it's clear that Roberto De Zerbe feels like that perhaps there's a disparity between their visions, that he wanted one thing. And I think it was Barber, he came out and said that De Zerbe had not told them off, but he said to stop going, oh, we need to be a top 10. He said, no, top 8, top 6, top 4, because that's the sort of mentality monster he is. And we've been praising him for that since he joined, and his honesty since he joined. So I do feel like you can't have it both ways. You can't praise him one moment, oh, he's so honest and great, and now it's, oh, he's being too honest. I don't like the ambiguity. I want the, no, this is the plan. I'm going to sit down with Tony and Paul and we're going to talk about what's going to happen. And if I don't feel like it fits in my interests, I'm going to go. I don't have an interest. I don't have a problem with that in the sense of, oh, De Zerbe, you're a terrible, terrible human being. I want De Zerbe to stay. I want them to find that middle ground. For me, I don't think Brighton are matching Roberto De Zerbe's short-term ambitions. Short-term there because, and I think you said it, Dagan, Tony Bloom and Barber, they've got to think long-term because they've got to think sustainability and they've got to think about where this club is going to be in 10 years. That's, and as is their prerogative. And I think, and I want to really preface this by saying how important Bloom is and how wonderful he is. And without him, there would be no, well, we wouldn't be where we are. But I sometimes feel that fans are so defensive, are so eager to defend Tony Bloom. Even the mildest bit of slight or criticism or questioning gets overblown. And now some people are ready to turn their backs on De Zerbe after what he's done for us because he's questioned.
I think it's because it's only him speaking. And listening to your guys' point, I think I've sort of found why I feel that way, and it's because it's his words. So my instant negative emotion about the fact that he could possibly leave just go straight to him. Because, you know, Bloom and Barber, I don't think would open a communication chamber with the fans just yet about Roberto De Zerbi's future because there's a season going on. So I think that's where my frustration unfortunately ends up. It ends up questioning De Zerbi because he's the only one talking about it.
Yeah, and I get that, but it's like Dagan says, you know, and I've said, he's been honest since he arrived. It would be out of character and perhaps, in my opinion, more worrying if he started saying things like, no comment. I say I appreciate the honesty because I don't like the ambiguity of no comment. And to me, that would speak to a much larger issue behind the scenes than suddenly him saying, not saying what he feels and thinks. But I understand why fans are angry or annoyed. But it, for me, it's a non-issue.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, I totally understand your point. I feel like you're reflecting the views of many, many fans who've been burned. It's a fair way to feel. It's a fair way to think about the whole thing. For me, it would be more worrying for him to say, I'm only focused on this team for the remainder of the season when the reports are coming in that these other clubs are talking to him. I don't know. I'm not worried. It's weird because if you'd asked me a year ago if we were here, would I be worried? I think I would have 100% thought that I would be more worried than I am. I just think if anything, I have more confidence in the club. And I also realize, like, for all of De Zerbi's, you know, magic, we haven't gotten back up to where we were when Graham Potter left. That's the truth. We were fourth when Graham Potter left. Short of, you know, the first couple weeks of the season when, you know, when everybody's sort of at the top, if you're not losing, we've not reached that high perch. And that's not to say Graham Potter's better, but it's just to say the world didn't come apart when Graham Potter left, when we were at our highest place ever. The world's probably not going to come apart when De Zerbi leaves. You know, from what I understand, we were going to fall apart when Chris Hughton left, right? We were going to rue the day that we let him go. I'm not a grass is always greener guy. Oh, it'll automatically be better, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's automatically going to be worse. Change is just change. If you trust the people who are making the changes, and in this case, I do, not blindly, but I think more often than not, Tony Bloom has gotten it right. And when he's gotten it wrong, he's made a swift correction, which to me, that says a lot, that he doesn't, you know, overestimate his own ability to make the right call such that he doesn't pivot when he feels like he's made a mistake. Right. There have been some short tenured managers where I'm sure he thought he had hired the right person, but then found out very quickly it wasn't correct. I wouldn't question Tony Bloom much. I mean, I fall into that camp, Tom, where I probably don't question him as much as some might. But no one's flawless.
I think it's quite a comforting conversation to have, because I feel like we're so quick to argue with each other, especially on Twitter. We're so quick to say, no, you're wrong. How dare you think that Roberto De Zerbi's leaving? Or no, you're wrong. Obviously he's leaving. But I think I feel quite comforted by both of your views, because it is exactly what you say. It's going to be fine. People move on. People have moved on. We're still the incredible club that we are. So I urge people to just have an open and honest discussion about how people feel about the way that this season could pan out, because it's not about right or wrong. It's about feelings and emotions connected to the thing that you love the most. It's great to hear other views, because as I say, I'm sat here feeling reassured, and I'm sure people listening to this will sit there and feel reassured, because it's, you know, two guys saying exactly the same thing pretty much. And I'm sat here like, well, actually, yeah. Like, why shouldn't I trust the club? But I think everyone's right to feel the way that they feel, because as I say, it's such a heightened emotion thing, especially towards the end of one of the most historic seasons we've ever had. So I think there's just a lot of roller coasters of everything going on upstairs. So, yeah, be comforted in other people's views is what I'm saying.
Yeah, this is not related, but it's tangentially. I met a guy today who's a Liverpool fan, but he's from Atlanta originally. He's a Atlanta United fan. And so I was asking him about Thiago Almada, who has been in some circles linked to us, I believe. And I was asking him, you know, where does he think he's going to go? Where does he hope he goes? And he actually said that, you know, Brighton was one of the places and the kind of place that he hoped he would go, right? That's really great at developing young players. It's just another example of this is an American fan that grew up, you know, a Liverpool fan, and who identifies Brighton as the kind of place where a young talent that he cares about, he hopes they would go to. And I think that's a shift. And I think that's not just fans. I think that's young players, right? I mean, the future is bright. It's really easy to get mired in. Maybe we've taken a little bit of a step back this year. I don't think the club has taken a step back, right? The season may be a little bit of a setback from last year, but I think we are still the ascending club that we imagined ourselves to be as we hit six last year. I don't think that's changing. And I think, again, if you play this season out 100 different times, I think there are versions of it where we end up in the top five. And I think there are probably some versions where we end up 12th, but nonetheless, I don't think we're dramatically, you know, better or worse than we were last year, despite the weaker midfield.
I think the issue that we have this year that we didn't have last year was just the rampant injuries, the additional games. And of course, we've seen teams in the past, I mean, Burnley, Wolves spring to mind, that have gone into Europe and then fallen down the table quite dramatically. We have yet to do that. So there is still hope. And let's keep the hopeful news going then. Of course, you've already mentioned it, I think, Dagan. The club posted today that they have made a £122.8 million profit for the 22-23 season. Which is massive. It doesn't include the sales of Moises Caicedo and Robert Sanchez to Chelsea. That'll be in next year's accounts. And it's been quoted here by saying, we now have a very solid platform to continue to make significant progress on the pitch by investing in our squad. The dream is to be regularly challenging for a European place and for silverware. We are very proud of Roberto, the work he and his staff have done, and of course, the performance levels of our squad. I mean, all the rumblings that have been happening this week with Roberto De Zerbi, we talked about there about Roberto De Zerbi's quote, was saying he wanted to sit down with Bloom and Barber and discuss the plan. Well, here's some great news. We've just made all this money. As you say, Dagan, financial fair play is coming into effect, and it's going to be stinging some teams. Teams like Leicester are going to be having to offload some of their players. You mentioned Dewsbury Hall. We've been linked to him. So this really could be a fantastic time for Albion to sit down with Roberto and say, hey, look, we've got this big plan in the summer. So, Joe, I mean, you've talked about your worries that De Zerbi leaves, but for you, is this the sort of the carrot, if you like, that is going to hopefully make Roberto De Zerbi stay and hopefully get them on the same page, which I'm sure would be in the best interests of both parties, fans included as well.
Yeah, and I think, again, gives me a little bit more pessimism going into the rest of this season because I want it out the way so we can spend that money. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a really exciting summer. And, of course, I hope that is with Roberto De Zerbi at the helm. But, you know, if we move on, I'm sure it's going to be another capable candidate that can take us forward and have us challenge for a European place. Obviously, they've not said what European place they want to challenge for. Dagan, of course, you hope it's Champions League, but I really wouldn't be mad if it was just Conference League every year. Obviously, we want to look forwards and we're in a really healthy position to know that the Moises Caicedo deal isn't even in those accounts yet. And those accounts are to be posted next April. That is going to look extremely healthy. So we could even be reporting more profits next season, even having spent a lot of money in the summer, and which people are going to be like, how are Brighton doing it? And I think a lot of people are saying, look at this club. Look at how well run they are. I know that there's an account on Twitter called The Sportsman, and they regularly tag Albion Obsessed, which we're really thankful for. And they posted, as I said, that we're just such a well-run club and we're in such a healthy position with all of these FFP allegations coming out. Everton, Forest, you know, City are under the microscope at the moment. So we're in a really healthy position. So yeah, I'm very eagerly waiting for the summer transfer window to open and to see what names we get linked with. I think it could be really exciting.
I can't wait for us to be linked with some amazing powerhouses across Europe and then buying some 17-year-old from the Romanian fifth tier to be sold in 7 years for £200 million. It's going to be fantastic. Yeah, I'm I'm yet to, perhaps I'm like Roberto Zerbi. I'm perhaps yet to be convinced. Dagan, a lot of money. That's a lot of money. So are you hopeful that we could actually see some, I'm going to say it, just first-team ready players? Because I think you pointed out earlier, we spent a lot of money last summer, no doubt about that. Out of all those players, João Pedro is probably the one who's played the most minutes. Baleba getting more minutes now because of injuries to other players. And Verbruggen obviously been rotated with Steel. So we've spent a lot of money, sure, but we perhaps haven't spent a lot of money on first team ready and first team quality players. Do you think hopefully the windfall of our profits will make Tony Bloom not less cautious, because that's probably the wrong phrase to use, but do you think that it might just give him a little bit of a nudge to sort of, yeah, you know what I'm getting at?
I do. I think we're going to continue to see purchase of prospects to be developed and sold at a high price. I think that is going to be a staple of how we operate. I think if we buy a $40 million player, I think it will be because we think we can flip him in a few years for 60 or 80 at a minimum. And I think that may be the difference, is we just have more capital now and more room because of the sort of continually strong sales that we can reinvest and kind of diversify our portfolio if we're looking at it financially, right? Where we can buy some of these maybe high risk, potentially low yield prospects that could be super high yield, but then also some more baseline. And I think of like a guy like Dewsbury Hall, who if we spend 40, there's a chance that maybe we, you know, can only get 30 for him later. There's also a chance we could double his value. He's still a pretty young guy. Locatelli, probably less so, right? He's a guy who's going to come in at 35 to 40 million, presumably. And you're probably not going to sell him for a whole lot more than that, because he's already is 26, I think. But if we feel like this is the get us over the hump, stabilizing force, leading the team, you know, especially if we think, you know, Gross is going to go to Germany in a year and we need someone to fill that spot, as sort of, you know, creative everyday midfield player, then maybe you do invest that big sum. Do I think we're going to go buy, you know, five $40 million players? Probably not. But I think we'll look at our needs. I think we'll bring in some young talent that can grow into roles and become spot contributors like we've seen with Enciso and Buonanotte and others. And I think Barco hopefully soon. But I think we'll probably see more signings this summer of a wide variety, a couple high end, you know, a couple in sort of that middle $20 to $25 million tier. And then, you know, a handful that are in the more normal sort of, you know, $15 million and under group. But I would not be shocked to see a $150 million outlay this summer.
Well, that's that would certainly be nice. Let's hope that sort of talk is enough to persuade Roberto De Zerbi to see out another season. Of course, if Liverpool or Bayern do come knocking, I think we're under no illusions that it's probably going to be Buonanotte to Mr. Roberto De Zerbi.
I've heard Roberto does listen to the Albion Obsessed podcast, so I'm sure he's writing up his new contract right now.
My guy, Roberto, if you are listening, which I know you're not, but please don't go. We've spent 35 minutes talking about the news. We had to cover it. It is the news that is on everyone's lips this week. So thank you for sticking with us. If you're here just to listen to the game, we are going to now talk about that. It's, of course, Liverpool versus Brighton yesterday on Easter Sunday. Brighton have had a fantastic record against Liverpool over recent seasons. And Joe, it looked like Brighton were going to start the best possible way to keep that record going. Brighton have been slow at starting, I think it's fair to say, this season at times, but we were ahead within 2 minutes. The ball being moved out of the Brighton half after a loose pass by Salah, I think it was, and then the Liverpool defence make a complete mess of clearing the ball, and Welbeck rifles it in from about 15 yards out. Welbeck has been in fantastic form recently, Joe, and he gets us on the score sheet nice and early. What did you make of the goal and the fast start?
Yeah, well, I was a little bit behind on my stream on Now TV, and your message came through, Tom, and you said, well, dot, dot, dot. And I thought, oh, no. Oh, no. My mind went to the worst. So I was pleasantly surprised to see Danny Welbeck strike a volley into the far corner and have us 1-0 up after 2 minutes. And yeah, the bad part is that we had 88 to go plus stoppage time. So yeah, I think I was chatting to my stepdad on the way to Shoreham today, and I was saying that there's so many different mentalities attached to when you score a goal. And I think that the phrase scoring too early is so true. And I think we saw it last season against Villa at home, didn't we? That we scored after the first, few seconds. And then they went on to win 2-1, funnily enough. So, yeah, I think it was great to see us start that way. I just wish that we sort of built on that a little bit more and sort of struck the fear into Liverpool, because we've got the quality to do so. Obviously, you know, we're without Julio and Ciso, Matoma, João Pedro. There's probably other names that I'm missing. But we still got
Billy Gilmore.
How could I forget Billy Gilmore? Billy Clifford Gilmore, thank you. So yeah, I think it was frustrating not to see us sort of just take that confidence and put them to the sword a little bit more. But then again, you're against title chasing Liverpool at Anfield, so they're always going to sort of turn it on afterwards. But yeah, nice to see us go up 1-0 and have a little bit of a dream that it might turn into a good afternoon.
Yeah. David, I know you love a stat. 87 seconds, Danny Welbeck's goal. That was the earliest 1-0 lead by a visiting side in a Premier League game at Anfield since Tottenham in 2019, where Harry Kane scored after 47 seconds. So not bad company to be in at all.
Not bad at all. Not bad at all. I was looking back. I was just trying to look at Liverpool's lost a few games over the past few months, a cup game, a couple Europa League group stage games. They've only lost one Premier League game, one since September. We battled. I mean, we had a great start. We got up, but they are they're an in-form team that's been formidable and capable of scoring a huge number of goals. We talked before, and speaking of loving a stat, right? 30 shots. They took 30 shots against us, which we could not find a game over the past 2 years where we gave away more. Arsenal earlier this season was 26, we found, but that was the high point. So, you know, to give away 30 shots, to lose 2-1, I mean, certainly some of that's on Liverpool and maybe not finishing as well as they usually do. But I will say, I think we got more guys back behind the ball and defended with some energy, some effort, some enthusiasm in ways that didn't make it overly easy on them. I mean, the first goal was truly unlucky. The second was just quality. And we lost Mo Salah, maybe somewhat inexplicably, in space. But the movement of the ball, I think, got us a little spun around, and it was, yeah, McAllister thinking quickly. The first, and again, the first was a mistake, and against a team that good, one mistake is too many.
Yeah, I mean, you talked there, Dagan, about Liverpool's chances. I think it's fair to say, Joe, you know, Liverpool responded to going 1-0 down very, very well, and if Mo Salah had brought his shooting boots, he says, ironically, considering he scored in the second half, Mo Salah could have had two or three goals before halftime, going wide on several occasions. McAllister, I think, blazed a header over as well. Liverpool were all over us, Joe. They were so intense. You could really tell that they were a team that are vying for the title.
Yeah, and I think that was reflected in what Jurgen Klopp said after the game. And he said it's the first time in a very, very, very long time that they've dominated Brighton. And I think that's something that we can take away positively, that, you know, a team chasing the title are happy that they've ground out a 2-1 win over us. And as you say, if they'd brought their shooting boots, it could have been a lot worse. I think Bart Verbrugge made a couple of extremely good saves. Roberto starts him for the rest of the season. Thank you. So I think, as Dagan said, we battled so hard. And there was a lot of defending in there that was really good. There was a lot of defending in there that was really bad. Pervis Stupinian, I'm looking at you. So, I think we could just be grateful we didn't get pummeled, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I want to talk about that first goal because it's quite been a spot of contention on X in regards to, you know, whether that goal should have stood or not. So let's just reflect it back. Ball went out for a corner. Liverpool send it in. The ball is headed back into, not well, it's headed back, it, you know, half cleared. It's gone back into danger. And it, Veltman attempts to clear the ball, only for it to fall to Diaz, who volleys in. Now, of course, you know, Bruno said this, Diaz was onside. There's no argument there. But a lot of people were saying that Veltman has only tried to play the ball because the players behind him, who were offside, were there. So surely that's interfering with play. Dagan, do you think those people that are saying that have got a point, or do you think it is just a case of it was a fair goal?
I don't know. It seemed like an earnest attempt to play the ball. I think he would have tried to, I think he tried to clear it because it was going into a dangerous position. Like, I don't think he tried to clear it because there were players offside. Like, I think he tried to clear it because the ball was going to go into a dangerous position that he wasn't sure the keeper could handle. So, I don't know. That's, I would certainly feel very hard done, as you guys say, if that was a goal disallowed and we were the goal scorers.
Oh, if we had scored that, it would have been disallowed.
I hesitated to say that. I'd rather you say it than for me. I don't know. That, again, on the Klopp tour, that's not getting disallowed.
Yeah, it's as you say. Like, I can kind of see their point. Because, you know, I mean, you don't know what Veltman's thinking. You don't know if he knows that they're there, or as you say, he's just sort of swung his leg at it in the hopes that, you know, it stops, you know, Bart from being in a position where he can't deal with something. So I can sort of see where they're coming in, you know, the argument of, oh, but they're interfering with play. Because if Veltman does know they're there, does he might not necessarily be able to see the defender on the far side of the pitch and where they're stood, so he doesn't know that they're offside. So I can kind of see where they're getting at, but it's, to me, it's a bit clutching at straws. That's just my opinion. Joe, good, you know, fair goal, or any contention from you at all?
No, not really. As soon as I saw it, Veltman tried to clear it, I knew Diaz was onside. I didn't even clock the two offside players, which is probably bad considering I want to be a coach and I'm missing all these details. But to be honest, I just didn't see it. I sound like Arsene Wenger, don't I? Ooh, I didn't see it. But no complaints from me, to be honest.
No, as I say, clutching at straws. I think if we had scored that at Anfield, it would have been chalked off. I'm going to say it. I found some of the moaning from Liverpool fans yesterday about the ref quite amusing, considering Diaz should have had like three yellow cards by half time. And they're like, oh, the referee is so biased, he doesn't want Liverpool to win. It's like, Diaz, mate, is a walking yellow card and he didn't get a single one.
Talk about bias, listen to bloody Jamie Carragher on the commentary. My gosh, what a Sky Sports on. And Stephen Warnock afterwards, talking about how much of a great find Alexis McAllister. Absolutely fucking ridiculous. I'm sorry. Sky Sports, sort your bloody pundits out. Get me to be a pundit. I could be better.
I don't doubt that for a second, Joe. Let's talk about Alexis McAllister and Dagan. What a great find for Liverpool. He seems to have stepped up quite a lot since leaving us, going to Liverpool. He was sensational yesterday. Just how good has Alexis McAllister become?
He's been very good. He has played largely in a deeper lying role at Liverpool than he did for much of the second half of the season with us, where we felt like he was maybe less effective than he had been in the early part of the season when he was, you know, playing exclusively in that midfield too. He's just a really good utility midfielder. He is capable of playing all three positions, and that, you know, either one of the central roles, lying deeper, 6, 8, or 10. And I feel like there are not a lot of guys out there that can do that. And I think given the other players in their midfield, and I feel like more than most teams, all of their midfielders are kind of interchangeable pieces. And so it really lets Klopp adjust game to game where he puts guys and what kind of role he has them doing. Yesterday, it felt like they had 13 players out there. It just felt like there was no room anywhere. They're counter pressing. It just felt like we'd get the ball and give it right back with little hope of keeping it. And they dominated possession. And I think we still had maybe 46% of the ball or something like that. But I'm lagged out, aren't I?
And Dagan has gone due to technical issues. But I think, the point being made is spot on. They were intense. They were all over us like white on rice. It was a tough day for Albion. I think it's fair to say. And McAllister, Dagan mentioned there about, you know, being able to play in any one of those midfield roles, Joe. The only other player that off the top of my head I can think of that can do that is Jude Bellingham. And he's obviously one of the greatest midfielders in the world. We've just momentarily lost Dagan. Hopefully he'll return. But Joe, as sure as night follows day, Mo Salah does eventually get a goal against the Albion like he likes to. And it was Alexis McAllister that got the assist. You had to feel like, Joe, that second goal, it certainly was coming. You know, we've already talked about Liverpool sort of intense attack. It was just a matter of time, surely.
Really annoying to see it be Alexis that gets the assist. Obviously, it's great to see him. He's very humble towards the club. Obviously, clapped the fans afterwards as well, which was really a great touch from him. But I just wish he didn't play so bloody well. So thanks for that, Alexis. You ruined my Easter. How could you? After all we've been through together. I think Sky Sports showed a stat throughout the game where it said the most goals a player has scored against Brighton. No, oh my gosh. My wording there was atrocious. The most goals a player has... I got that right. Shut up, Joe. Mo Salah was like towards the top of the... It's been a long day. It really has. Mo Salah was towards the top of that list. And I think it came as no surprise that it was Mo Salah that sealed the deal for Liverpool. And I think from that point onwards, I just sort of looked forward to our annual derailment of the Arsenal title charge. So let's see if we can put in a stake and be the team that gets Arsenal out of the title race and give it to Alexis, because if you want anyone to win it, it's Alexis McAllister, and he's just so wholesome. I'm going to stop talking now because clearly I've lost my tongue. So.
Thank you, Joe. I mean, Dagan, it could have been worse. Mo Salah could have got a second for Liverpool's third, but if not for a truly wonderful save from Bart Verbrugge, using all of that frame to get down and to parry the ball out. An excellent save. I mean, we've already sort of alluded to it. Surely Bart's got to be sticks for the rest of the season. Surely.
I mean, yes, but probably not. If we're not announcing it, it's probably like we're probably going to continue to see Jason Steele. And I'm just not sure. I'm not sure how that fits into the grand plan. Like, is is there a chance that he's the starting goalkeeper on day one next year? Is there a chance that, like, do we still think he's better? I mean, I don't know. I just haven't seen the kind of mistakes from Bart with his feet that we saw early in the season that made people say, well, Steele's better with his feet. I don't see it anymore. I've run numbers and people say, oh, they're just numbers and they're not fair. And I don't know. The eye test, everything tells me that Bart is at least as good, in my opinion, better, but at least as good at worst. And so I don't understand the rationale playing a much older, not improving, not a part of our long-term future, Jason Steele. At least as a starter, he may be a cup keeper. And I like Jason Steele. Like, he's a great guy, great teammate. He's an incredible story. I just would love to see, can he get on a good run, right? Can he get on a good run where he's making saves like we saw yesterday, keeping us in the game, because he kept us in the game with that save, and a game that we nearly eked out a tie late. We really did. We nearly eked out a point. I really thought Welbeck's shot was in the net, the one he hit in the side netting late. But I think Bart keeps us in it with that save.
Yeah, yeah, another person on this podcast manipulating a stat, honestly.
We do love to manipulate those stats. But you're right, Degan. I think, you know, in the last 10 minutes, you know, we did have, you know, for all of Liverpool's attacking impetus, we had a good couple of chances. There was a fantastic dunk header, which Kelleher had to scramble across his line to save, because that was creeping in. Lallana shot just wide. And as you say, Welbs fired into the side netting after a really nice pass from Buonanotte. So we did, you know, push them for those last 10 minutes, and it did seem like we might be able to eke out a draw, but it just, unfortunately, it just wasn't to be. And that isn't to say that it wasn't initially a bad performance, because I don't think it was a bad performance, although there were some really good individual performances out there. Don't get me wrong, I thought Purvis wasn't particularly great. I thought Lamptey was, again. And I'm just going to really come to this before I talk about three players I wanted to talk about. I was really disappointed not to see Barco brought on. I think I put in the group chat about around 60 minutes. I think, oh, Barco's getting instructions. We're going to see him soon. He didn't come on for like another half an hour. I was a bit like, oh, I was really disappointed, especially with how poorly Lamptey and Purvis were playing. Really thought we'd see Barco. Now, Dagan, I know that you're a big fan of Barco. You've got his jersey there behind you. I assume you were it's equally disappointed as I was not to see him feature a bit more than the last, 6 minutes of added on time.
Yeah. I think it was disappointing more than anything was just how little time there was, and how I think he overplayed his hand trying to make something happen. And he's prone to do that anyway, right? To try to create something out of nothing, but it ended up in him giving the ball away several times, maybe needlessly, but it was just out of, all right, well, I've got to try to create something. What I thought was promising was the degree to which he was fed to create those kinds of chances. It seemed like the other players recognized, well, if anyone's going to create something here, it might be Barco. So that to me was, you know, an encouraging sign to how he's viewed within the squad. I would have loved to have seen him earlier. I thought we kept guys on after the half too long. And I think I said in the chat, I'd love to see X, Y, or Z, you know, before we're down a goal. And then I think promptly we went down a goal. And then we started making the changes. And I don't know, it just felt like it was coming, and we needed to do something to get some guys out there who could get the ball out of our own half. And we waited a beat too long for that.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I know that some people were calling for Fatty to come on. I personally was not particularly for that idea. I would have rather have seen Barco. But Joe, I said just before we started talking about Barco that there were a number of good performances. I'm going to come to him first and foremost. Lewis Dunk, I thought, you know, he had a good game yesterday. Back to, you know, his usual self. I mean, he's not been particularly brilliant in the league recently, had a bit of a torrid time away with England. I thought the game yesterday, he played well. I thought Baleba was excellent as well. And Jakob Moda as well. I think I put it in the group chat quite early on. It was so nice to see a tall midfielder win a ball in the air. I couldn't quite believe. I mean, I love Billy Gilmore. Fantastic player. I really like Pascal Gross. But it was nice to see a bit of bite, a bit of physicality in the middle, Joe. Mm.
Yeah. I just want to touch on Dunkey, first of all. You said torrid time of England. I actually don't think he was that bad. I don't think it was as bad as what people are making it out to be. Obviously, there's one huge mistake against Lukaku, which opens up Belgium to score their second goal. Was it their second goal? But other than that, like, he could have got an assist had Bowen stayed onside. And he played a huge part in the equaliser as well in terms of his physicality and winning the ball. Watkins keeps it alive and Bellingham slots it home. So I think he made a decent enough account of himself to still be in contention with going to the Euros. I think people are writing him off way too soon. And yeah, he's been disappointing this season. And people are saying, oh, his call-ups come 2 years too late. But I really do still think he's one of the best English centre-backs out there. I don't think you could tell me that Maguire or Gehi or Branthwaite are any better than Lewis Dunk. They might be level, not Maguire. Put Maguire to the back. But Gehi and Branthwaite have been good. But I don't see them much better than Lewis Dunk. And certainly to have an option where you've got a centre-back that's been playing out from the back under a fantastic manager, having the opportunity to play alongside John Stones as well, who's coached by one of the best in the world, I think it could be a really interesting pairing. So for people to be writing Lewis Dunk off, I think is crazy. And yeah, backed up his England performances with a good performance at Anfield against title contenders. So I think that says enough for me that Lewis Dunk is still in and around being called up to go to Germany. Yeah, and talking about Belabor and Moda, you know, how good it is to have two physical midfielders that are they didn't look out of their depth at all against a really, really good Liverpool midfield. I mean, Endo and McAllister as a pairing are scary. And Szoboszlai just ahead of them is a real handful. So the scoreline doesn't quite reflect how dominant Liverpool were, but I think our midfield was at times capable of dealing with them. And I think that is huge credit to Belabor and Jakob Moda. So yeah, I think they're really good three players to point out that were had a really good performance. And I think another one that has to be shouted out, we've already given Bart the shout out, but I think Van Hecker was really good again, and has been absolutely phenomenal this season. I saw a Chelsea fan talking to Brightonian, I think it was Brightonian, saying about how Cole Will's better than Van Hecker, and it's absolutely crazy. Van Hecker has become leaps and bounds a fantastic centre-back pairing with Lewis Dunk, and is going to be absolutely huge for us next season. I've got a huge feeling.
Yeah, definitely. I couldn't agree more, Joe. Dagan, just before we move on to player of the match, any standout performances on a you know, team scale for you?
Yeah, I mean, Belabor to me was a standout, both in his pace. So often when Liverpool looked to have a dangerous attack, I feel like he was a part of disrupting, whether directly winning the ball back or just slowing them up a little bit, and then carrying the ball. He was very effective, drew several fouls that I can think of. Liverpool committed 20 fouls. For those, they had collected a grand total of 3 yellows up until the 88th minute, and they got 2 late yellows after that point. But I thought there were numerous moments where we were starting to mount a dangerous counterattack, and they just, you know, with great precision, you know, gave a professional foul over and over and over again. And often you see those, you know, as yellows. They were not in this game. And, you know, when I bemoan officiating, that comes to mind. So standout performance in not giving out yellow cards early to Liverpool, perhaps by who was it yesterday? I can't remember,
but the ironic thing was David Coote
yesterday.
The first yellow card for McAllister, in my mind, it wasn't even a foul.
Yeah.
He's given a yellow card out for McAllister and a Dingross just falling over. There's just a certain level of irony there. So
Although who got the yellow when McAllister kicked them?
Gross got yellow for that as well. Again, that was a ridiculous yellow card. But you feel like that's almost like just he was trying to even it up.
Uh-huh.
It was 50-50. Both their feet are at the same height. They just kicked one another. It is what it is.
The crowd made that call, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. It's quite funny, isn't it? You know, we talked off air. A lot of Liverpool fans bemoan officiating and, like, you know, the refereeing world is against them. Yet Diaz committed numerous fouls in the first half, wasn't booked at all. But hey ho, we digress. Man of the match, then, lads. Man of the match. Joe, I'm going to come to you first, my friend. Who was your man of the match?
My man of the match, as I just send out the link for the She Goals podcast, shout out to the She Goals. Please go and listen to She Goals, powered by Albion Obsessed. They're doing amazing work. I just thought I'd get that shout out whilst I'm sending them all an email. My man of the match, I think, would have to go to Bart Verbruggen. I think it could have been a lot worse had it have been Jason Steele in the net. And I think I want to give it to Bart because it stakes the claim again that he should be starting as our number one goalkeeper in all of the important matches this season and next season and going forwards for the next, hopefully, long, long time that he stays with us. Bart Verbruggen for me.
Very fair indeed. Dagan,
I'm going to take
you?
My usual... Oh, am I there? I'm going to take my usual metal stand approach. Bart for me is in the bronze medal position. I agree, Joe. He did keep us in it. Baleba is very much in the running, but I'm going to give him the silver. But my gold medal man of the match, Danny Welbeck started us out, and I think getting a goal that early and, you know, with a clinical finish on a beautiful strike, That's a man of the match worthy singular moment in a game where sometimes a singular moment is all the difference. And, you know, I think having that goal in hand, though perhaps we scored too early, it put us in a position to be in the game throughout the game and in a game that we frankly didn't otherwise feel like we deserved to be in, given the way it was going. So just for producing a moment of brilliance, I don't think I've given Danny Welbeck a man of the match before. I'm going for Danny Welbeck in this one.
More than fair. Yeah, it was a fantastic goal he scored at the beginning, and he almost got a second late on. I'm going to give mine to, I've already said it, Baleba for me. I thought Baleba was excellent. And I also thought Moda did really well as well. Didn't really put too many feet wrong, as it were. But I thought it was an okay performance, and I think we've had some not great performances recently. It was nice to see us set up in a 4-2-3-1. Or a 4-4-1-1, however you want to put those numbers, back four, basically. That was nice. Disappointing not to get a result, but as Dagan says, we probably, on the face of it, didn't deserve one. But we certainly made them work hard at the end. Let's look ahead then, Joe. In a couple of days' time, we face Brentford, which is always an interesting game. Ivan Toney will be an interesting one to watch. We know that Albion centre-backs usually find dealing with quite physical strikers can be quite difficult, as we saw with Lukaku. We've seen it with Toney before. We've seen it with Haaland before. So does that worry you, or do you think we're, you know, coming off the back of an okay performance against Liverpool, we should be hopefully galvanised into one of the games that we have left that many will see as a almost must win?
Yeah, I think Brentford are still pretty much fighting to stay up. I don't think they've been absolutely fantastic this season at all by any stretch. But I think they are a much different side with Ivan Toney back in the squad. And had our game fell the good side of his ban and he'd not been playing, I would have fancied our chances a lot more. But going off of how he was against us last season, He scored, I think, 3 goals against us last season, 1 at home and 2 at their place. So, yeah, it's really going to be probably a frustrating game, and another one where there's a physical striker dealing with Lewis Dunk, but hopefully Dunkey would have got a few answers as to how to deal with him on England duty. So hopefully he's been making his notes. But yeah, I think it's going to be another really tough game. And by any stretch, I don't think we're going to go out there and absolutely hammer them. I think it's going to be like sort of 1 or 2 either way.
Hmm. Yeah, they were excellent against Man United as well, weren't they? How they didn't actually win that game, I'm not quite sure. Brentford also very good at the dark arts of football as well. Time-wasting. Hooray, I'm looking forward to that already. Dagan, what are your thoughts ahead of the Brentford fixture?
Yeah, I just did a quick look back, and apologies if my count is off, but going back to our game against them on December 6th, that we won 2-1, including that game, they have won twice since then. 2 wins, 3 draws, 13 losses in that stretch of time. It has been not great for Brentford. Naturally, it makes this an utterly terrifying game to go there to play them. Because I will say, watching them of late, they do look to be in better recent form. Yeah. With, you know, 2-1. I mean, they also have a 2-1 loss to Burnley in there. Did they go man? They went a man down early in that game, though. They went a man down early. That's right. In the 9th minute, they went a man down. Oof. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it worries me. We beat them 2-1 at our place. I'm gonna say we win 2-1 again, or 1-2. That's my prediction. But it won't be easy. It seems to never be with Brentford.
No, it's what is it? The Bloom, I can't remember his name. The Bloom something derby, Bentham. The guy that Brentford. Yeah, and we've got Neil Mopay as well, so that could be interesting.
He's been getting a little less time. We've seen more Wissa and Tony.
Yeah, but it's written in the stars, Dagan. Written in the stars. You just know it's going to happen.
Please no. It's a must win. It is a must win, given the fixtures that we have coming up. This and like Burnley away are just 2 games we really have to have. I think we have Arsenal and City flanking those games. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's all fun and games being a Brighton supporter. But as you know, I've sort of alluded to in this podcast already, there's still a lot of hope to play for. The European places could drop down to 9th place, I believe it is. Is it 8th or 9th?
8th.
So it could drop down to as low as 8th, which is a feasible position for Brighton to finish in. But it does rely on us, you know, having a good run of form, which is going to be really tricky against the clubs that we are, of course, still to play. But we'll talk about that next time out, and hopefully we'll come to you next time on the back of a victory. But all that's left to say is don't forget to check out one shop, Klopp Shop. There we go. I don't want to say Klopp Shop. Bloody Jurgen Klopp with his bloody Liverpool and his stuff. But no. Check out One Klopp Shop and you can get 10% off your order of vintage football shirts using the code ALBIONOBSESSED. Joe has his hand up like we're in class. Joe, it's Easter break. I ain't taking class today, son.
I want to give another shout out to our sponsors, footballprizes.co.uk. They are currently running a signed Roberto De Zerbi away shirt giveaway. It's framed. And also, if you enter for a price of £3.95 per ticket, you get entered into another giveaway for an Adam Webster signed shirt as well. So why not? footballshirtprizes.co.uk/product/Zerbi. The link will be in the description. Go and buy a ticket. There's only 149 available. You could well win.
Go and do those things, please. That would be really, really lovely. And don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to the Albion Obsessed. This is the sort of podcast where we'll trip over our words, we'll have technical issues, but hey-ho, you get honesty as premium. Don't have to pay for that. let us know your thoughts in the comment section down below, because I really want to know what you guys think about Roberto De Zerbi's comments. That is, of course, going to be a hot topic over the next couple of weeks, I'm sure. And I'd love to get some of the listeners' views on that. Don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter and, or should I say X, and let us know there as well. All that's left for me to finally say after an hour and 10 minutes of waffle, wherever you may be, whenever you may be, we'll see you next time. Take care.